This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and as part of our year-end wrap-up, of course, every year, you know, we hear from our producers, and they tell us their favorites from the year gone by, and we're going to do that again this year. But first, we thought we'd do something a little bit different. Today, we thought we would turn the mics and ask our listeners to make their selections. We asked, was there a topic that drew you in, a conversation that you found most engaging? And you responded with a nice variety of shows that I think highlights the diversity of topics that we cover on the State of Things. We're talking listener favorites today, and we're going to start with a topic that, of course, received a lot of airtime in 2016, not just here, but all across the country, and in fact, all over the world. The topic, of course, HB2. Let's listen.
I'm Becky Carey. I'm calling from Durham, and my favorite part of the State of Things this year has been the ongoing coverage of HB2. I very much appreciated how consistently it was covered, the attempts to hold people accountable for how quickly it was rushed through without any time for debate or looking at actual evidence, and that it was fair and it was polite, but it was firm and it was ongoing. I also very much appreciated Frank's references to people's God-given gender, because I think that someone's gender is a part of their fundamental identity. And as a person of faith, I believe that people's fundamental identities come from God. So a transgender woman is a woman, and that is part of her God-given self.
That was a clip from listener Becky Carey. And here's a portion of our HB2 coverage. This was from a show we did live from Raleigh. It was a preview of the legislative short session, and it originally aired on April 26th. I began by asking Republican Representative Paul Stamm if there's any chance the Republican-led General Assembly would repeal HB2. Let's listen.
No, and let me address Representative Martin's complaint there. The bill essentially, for all practical, on this point, maintains the status quo before March 23rd. So, for example, take PayPal. We have the same law today that we had when PayPal announced a week before we changed, before we passed the law, that we had then. These folks who said they're going to take a convention away or that not, we have the same law today that we had when they scheduled their convention to start with. We also have the same law as 29 other states on matters of discrimination. And on matters of bathroom usage, we have the same law as about 10,000 other cities in America. So,
well, let me just stop you there, because
yes,
it does seem that those companies are reacting to a particular law that you passed, that you had to have a special session to pass because it wasn't on the books, and that's the thing they're reacting to. Am I right, or did I get that wrong?
They're reacting to news accounts of what was done.
But there was a law that was different now than was in place, and that's what they're reacting to. No?
No. No. No.
Not a different law.
What
was the special?
Charlotte.
Forgive me then.
Yes, I'll forgive you
well,
and explain.
Please do, because I'm confused about why the special session.
I'll forgive
session.
You and explain it to you.
All right. Well, do both of those, because there was a special session
points,
and a new law.
On these points.
Yes.
The city of Charlotte had passed an ordinance,
right,
which was to go into effect April 1,
right,
and was going to radically change the law for business, for 20,000 business owners in Charlotte. What we did on March 23 was pass a law that stopped that, maintained the status quo on matters of what is discrimination, what is not discrimination, and what had been normal bathroom usage and North Carolina and most of America for centuries.
So that thing that stopped Charlotte from doing what the voters of Charlotte wanted, that's the thing they're reacting to. That changed, and that's why those jobs aren't coming here. So what about that? Does that affect the state? If you hadn't done that, they wouldn't have said, Deutsche Bank, for instance, wouldn't say, big corporation, we're not coming to North Carolina, if you hadn't stopped Charlotte from doing what it wanted. That's a change, right? I mean, to be honest, to be fair.
Well, the reason they're doing it is not fair, because when they announced they were coming to start, and they're still here. Deutsche Bank is still here. This was an expansion.
An expansion.
We're talking about. When they came and when they announced their expansion, we had the same law that we have today. So their reason is completely bogus.
Chris Grove, what is it about this law? You are now new to the legislature. You have been an outspoken opponent of HB2. What is it about this that you find different and objectionable?
Sure. So I don't think it's accurate that we have the same law today now that we did before what Charlotte passed. Charlotte passed a best practice ordinance that over 100 cities in the country already have in place, like Myrtle Beach in Columbia, South Carolina. Ordinances that Governor Nikki Haley there has said there's no need for a bill like House Bill 2. House Bill 2 didn't just say that we can have discrimination. It says that there must be discrimination in the use of those facilities and set an entirely new standard around what is or is not gender. So above and beyond its impact, you know, we talk a lot about the impact on bathrooms, but this also allows cities, it forces the state to say that there's no cause of action in terms of racial discrimination in employment anymore. It directly targets gay and transgender people for violence, I believe. And it strips municipalities of their ability to pass common sense ordinances.
Now, there's nothing in the language of that law that targets gay and transgender individuals, right? There's no legal requirement that they be targeted when you use a phrase like that. How does that happen?
When transgender people can't use a restroom in a public place anymore because they very clearly present as a woman and are a woman but are forced to either risk violence or go into the men's room, that is not right.
That was a portion of a show we did in April, live from Raleigh, and it featured a panel of lawmakers including Chris Groh, Paul Stamm, Floyd McKissick, Greer Martin, Chuck McGrady, and Mike Woodard, all talking about their perspectives on HB2. Our next listener also appreciated our coverage on LGBTQ rights, this time told from the perspective of a personal experience. Let's listen.
My name is Kathy Williams, and I live in Greensboro, North Carolina. And the show that I really enjoyed was the show in Greensboro right before Thanksgiving. One of the interviews was with the folks who are responsible for the Out of the South Project, which is an LGBTQ project. And while I don't remember the names of the individuals who spoke, I was incredibly impressed by a young woman who talked about her journey coming out to her parents in rural North Carolina, and how incredibly difficult that was, but how incredibly powerful it was. The rejection that ensued, the healing that later ensued, it was incredibly moving to hear her bravery and courage in the process that followed. And in light of the difficulties that our community has had this year with HB2, I found myself thinking that the entire North Carolina legislature probably should have that project as their required reading and or listening.
That was listener Kathy Williams talking about one of the broadcasts we did live from Triad Stage in Greensboro. That was back in November. The show she was talking about was called Out in the South, and she deemed it required listening for the North Carolina legislature. Here's a portion of that interview. My guest name is Ivy Gee, and in the clip, I ask her what changed for her when her mother, a pastor in an African-American church in the South, finally accepted her as gay.
Well, what changed for me was the moment, like I said, that she had this blessing and this aha moment that she wanted to accept me wholeheartedly. It made me feel invincible. It made me feel like I could do anything that I set my mind to. And of course, I knew that because I loved being the girl who got in suits and put on a bow tie or a tie, that I was going to get the strangest looks. And I found myself, when I would go to the bathroom, kindly announcing or saying hi in a really nice soft voice so no one would get concerned about why is Ivy in the suit in the bathroom. But being able to share this experience really had people in this community coming up to me. I will always remember this gentleman who came up to me. We were actually colleagues working together, and he said, "Ivy, that story hit right on time." And I said, "What do you mean, brother?" He said, "Before I read your story, my daughter was going to her prom, her eighth grade prom. And my wife was dragging her around to all of these dress shops, and she wasn't happy. I could see that she wasn't smiling, but she was going to do it for her mom." And then we read your story, and my daughter was shining so bright at her prom. She was able to find the nice pantsuit that made her feel comfortable, that made her feel engaged, and it made her want to go and show off with a smile instead of just, you know, giving in to what people felt like was normal or what people felt like was okay. And I felt like this was the reason why. It had to be the reason why. Why not share? Why not inform people and let them know that the reason why we're able to be who we are and be so fabulous, that's what they like to call us, is because we are supported by the people who matter the most. And I said in that story that anybody could walk up to me with their idea or their opinion of me, but it doesn't matter because my mama loves me and she accepts me.
That was Ivy Gee, whose personal story was featured in the series Out in the South, a podcast and series of columns published in Yes Weekly magazine in Greensboro. We had her on the show that was live from Greensboro. That was back in November. And I think, you know, one of the things I think you can appreciate from listening to that clip is the energy and the emotion that we feel. Certainly I feel it as a host, and I think our guests feel it too. When we have a live audience, it really changes what we do. So I do want to thank everyone who comes to our live shows. This is The State of Things. We're airing listener favorites today, and we'll have more listener picks from the past year on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Our listeners are directing today's show. We asked you to choose your favorite segments that we have produced in the past year, and today we're hearing from some of you. We already talked about our coverage of an important political issue in North Carolina. This next pick is from a listener who enjoyed one of our shows from our regular series called Back Channel. Let's listen.
Hi, this is Kim. I'm calling from Cary. I had heard a lot of discussion about Beyoncé's Lemonade album, but most of it was all about kind of her as a celebrity more than a person or an artist. A lot of it was about, you know, had she been cheated on by her husband, that kind of thing. And what Dr. Brown and Dr. Neal did was really focus more on her as an artist and what she was trying to say with her work. And not only did they discuss that, they went a level over that and talked about why are we discussing her more as a celebrity? You know, how do we approach celebrities of color and kind of, you know, look at them more as a symbol than a person or an artist. So that was really interesting to me and really kind of opened up my mind to a different way of looking at it.
That was Kim from Cary, a listener who chose our coverage of Beyoncé's album Lemonade as her favorite show from 2016, part of our monthly series Back Channel. The Dr. Brown she's referring to is Natalie Bullock Brown from St. Augustine's University in Raleigh, and Dr. Neal is Mark Anthony Neal, who teaches at Duke University. It starts with Duke University, this next clip you're going to hear, Duke University professor Mark Anthony Neal, and he's talking about Beyoncé's use of poetry by Warsan Shire.
I love the Warsan references. It brings a level of depth to it. And one of the things that Beyoncé does is she does not get a lot of credit for, generally in her career, but in particularly in terms of this album. I mean, she put a lot of people on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Warsan's publisher talked about the fact that, you know, because everything was embargoed, right, before, you know, it launches, they can't talk about it. So they couldn't let Amazon, .com know it's going to be future, right?
Yeah,
so they sold out
together.
Immediately yeah. because, you know, they were unprepared for the kind of attention that it was going to get. I think it gives it a depth. I think it gives it a certain kind of pacing. Right. It raises the bar in terms of thinking about it as an artistic piece. You know, folks are wondering, it's like, is Beyoncé writing poetry?
Right. Right.
It's like, you know,
right.
What's this about?
Right. And I think that, you know, the use of Warsan Shire's poetry also helps to blur this line between what is real and what is not. Because if you listen to if you watch the film, you have no idea if Beyoncé has written you know, this poetry. And I mean, when I first watched that, I was listening really intently. I was like, are those lyrics? Or did she write that, or is that something else? And it really does add to this mystique that permeates Lemonade, because we don't know. We think we know that she's talking about her life, that she's talking about her mom's life, her dad's life, her life with Jay-Z. But then, you know, we can't be too sure. And so I think it is a stroke of creative genius that she uses this young woman's poetry, and that poetry is so universal in tone, and it pulls you in because all of us can relate to what this poetry is about. So I think it's brilliant.
Well, let's play a clip, because a lot of people have weighed in on this. We're talking about critics, certainly in the Academy. It's a source of conversation, and fans, sometimes new fans. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Milton Tucker. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. My impressions with the Beyoncé's Lemonade album were that I thought it was a great album. I thought it was a great progression from what she's been doing career-wise. I really thought that the choice in musical stylings that differed from song to song was outstanding. I was very impressed with that, and I'm not typically a Beyoncé listener, but I just the style and the flow of this album really caught my attention.
A lot of people have been saying that it showed maturity. Mark, you had some thoughts about the fact that that there are so many genres embedded in this album. The fact is that R&B has taken on many forms already. It's not necessarily Beyoncé stepping out here.
You know, a lot of critics responded, you know, she's being daring, she's going multi-genre. But, you know, if you're a deep listener of R&B music, R&B music is always drawing from these influences, whether we're talking about contemporary R&B music or historically. You know, I think the thing that's important, you know, when we think about, you know, Milton mentions this idea of thinking about the maturity that we get in Beyoncé. You know, we have lots, you know, she started when she was 16, 17 years old. I mean, that's when she comes into public consciousness. So, you know, so we've had the opportunity to watch her grow up. And we get to watch many artists grow up, but when they grow up, it's not usually when they're at the peak of their fame.
Yeah.
What we see at Beyoncé is her at the peak of her maturation as an artist, and at the same time, at the apex of her career as a commercial artist. We very rarely have seen that. Maybe Michael Jackson, you know, in that mm-hmm. regard.
Popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown of St. Augustine's University and Mark Anthony Neal of Duke talking about the impact of Lemonade in our episode in the recurring series Back Channel. The Back Channel series is one of my favorites, too, because I don't often get to talk about popular culture in such an important way. Again, putting it in context. Another topic I wish we did more of is science. And the next listener chose one of our science segments as her favorite. Let's listen.
My name is Casey Novak, and I'm calling from Raleigh. My favorite episode of The State of Things this year was The Secret World of Microbes, where Frank Statio, I thought it was really funny because I didn't see the video, but I was listening to it on the radio. And the imagery of him getting swabbed for the microbe test was really amusing, even without seeing it in person. So just the imagery of Frank, you know, very stoic, well put together man with his shirt off in the middle of a lab getting swabbed was very powerful imagery without the visual. What I found was really interesting about that show was I have two kids and I'm not a fan of antibacterial products. So I felt like this was kind of vindicating for me to be supported in the fact that actually antibacterial, antimicrobials are maybe not the way we should be going as a society.
Listener Casey Novak talking about her favorite show this past year, a segment we called The Secret World of Microbes. And Casey, you chose wisely by not watching the video because it was not a sight that anyone should have seen, certainly not your children. Anyway, it was based on an exhibit at North Carolina's Museum of Natural Sciences. And my guests were biologist Julie Horvath and Rob Dunn. And in this clip, Julie is describing how she swabbed me for those microbes.
So you came to my lab a couple weeks ago, and we had this awesome Facebook Live event where we let you swab your own microbes, actually. Sometimes I swab people's microbes. Sometimes they swab their own microbes off of their skin. And you collected them on these rayon swabs that look like long Q-tips, and then I took those back to the lab on the bench, and I grew them up on Petri dishes, which had food for microbes. We call this LB media, and we grew your microbes up on a plate, and the first couple days of growth just looked like little white dots on this plate, and then over time, over 2 weeks, we actually got some really cool stuff growing on your armpit plates. So your right armpit has a lot of cool critters on it.
This is interesting too, because there's a variation. My right armpit is not the same as my left, it turns out.
Correct. Yeah, and there is variation between people's right and left body parts. So right and left hands are very different. We talk about that in the exhibit. Right and left armpits for some people are very similar. Other people, they're very different. And so it looks like your right and left side are very different.
This is so cool. Do you think they vote? Do you suppose my left armpit is going for Hillary and the right is a Trump vote? I don't know.
You'll have to ask them.
I'm going to do that, but you've got them now. So actually, I have a whole new colony and I'm over them. But tell me what you found. And because you said they were interesting and they do look very different from each other, so when you look at them, what are you seeing?
Well, I see potentially things that are very, very beneficial for you. So like Rob mentioned or alluded to, they produce your body odor. So they drink your sweat. And then what they release as their volatile chemicals are these odors that other people smell. So maybe you can choose a mate by how you smell. Primates do that a lot. You are a primate. And so some of these microbes are good for you because they produce your body odor. Other microbes protect your skin. They create this stable ecosystem to ward off any pathogenic or disease-causing microbe. And so they do a lot of good things for you too. And so I'm trying to figure out some of those things. What all do they do? And then how can we use this type of analysis where we culture people's microbes and give them back pictures of their plates? How can we use that to engage people and teach them more about the health of their body?
And we know from an adaptive standpoint, our body odor is a good thing because we're not that fast. We're really not that strong. So it's good that we don't smell like we taste that good. That's been part of how we got here, right? Or at least how we stayed. Have you given any thought? I mean, I know this is, you know, we're in the middle of doing the research now, and this is what you're looking for. But any speculation on why there would be a difference between the right and the left? One would think that, you know, all of these beneficial things, making use of my body, my making use of them, why would they care if they're on the right side or the left, and why would they be different?
Well, you know, you have different glands on different parts of your body, and so maybe you have more on one side or the other, and I don't think we know exactly why there might be some of these differences, but that's a really great question and maybe something we could explore more with further research.
Rob, I understand you're currently working on research that identifies the relationship between microbes and people's lifestyles, right?
Yeah, so we're really interested in what can you predict about somebody based on their microbes, or what can you predict about somebody's microbes based on their lifestyle? And some of that you can see in the exhibit. You can actually explore your own lifestyle and how it relates to what microbes you might have. But for example, if we can tell based on who lives in your house which microbes are likely to be floating around and landing on you and in your house. And so a house that's mostly inhabited by women is very different from a house that's mostly inhabited by men. This confirms our sort of anecdotal understanding of the lives of men and women, but it also turns up microbially. And so if you give us a swab of a house without telling us anything about it, we can do a pretty decent job of telling whether it's men or women who live in that house, partially because of vaginal bacteria, but partially because men are leaving armpit bacteria everywhere to a greater extent than women. But we can also tell, do you have a dog? Do you have a parrot? We can tell about where you live. And so I got a funny phone call one day when I was doing laundry late at night, and the person said, if we sent you a box, could you swab the dust in the box and tell us based on the microbes where the box came from? And I said, well, who is this? And they said, a government agency. And I said, well, I'm doing laundry. And so somehow that moved forward, and we decided to check with our data. Could we do this? Could we, based on swabs we've taken in houses, tell where a sample came from based on which species were found on that swab? And we can within 100 kilometers. And so we're now working with the Army Research Office to figure out, could we do this with explosive devices and the tape that's on an explosive device to figure out where it might have come from? And so there's a whole world that we're starting, now that we're looking at these microbes anew, there are many things that we could do in the future that we hadn't thought about doing in the past. And that's a pretty unusual example, but I think it speaks to how open this world of microbes is.
Biologists Julie Horvath and Rob Dunn with the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences talking about the ecosystem in my armpit. Next up, a listener with a long history in public education appreciated a segment that we aired called Listen to Your Mother. It was an event hosted at Meredith College that took place back in May, and it allowed participants to share their experiences of mothering in front of a live audience on Mother's Day.
My name is Barbara Rohde. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina. And one of my favorite shows was called Listen to Your Mother. I was listening to it on Mother's Day. It was about a teacher in the Durham Public Schools. I'm from a family of teachers. I've been a teacher for 30 years. My husband's a teacher. My mom and dad were both teachers. My daughters are teachers. We have a lot of teachers in the family. My ears perked up when I heard her describe her life as a teacher and as a mom and as an advocate for her daughter. She really does it all. She gives all her time and energy and positive attitude in her work and her life. I was particularly excited when she described her Men of Honor program for socially challenged young boys. And it really made me feel like the schools have a lot of very, very talented people working, and I was so glad to hear that.
That was listener Barbara Rohde telling us why she liked the segment we did about an event in Raleigh called Listen to Your Mother. One of the guests on that program was Durham Public Schools teacher Nashonda Cook, and I began by asking Nashonda to tell us why she submitted a story to Listen to Your Mother.
My friend Beth, who actually was one of the performers last year, said, "This is what you'll be doing next year." And I just said, "Yeah, okay, whatever. I'm not a writer. I'm a teacher. I check writing, but I'm not a writer." And I got the email. It was amazing.
Mother of two, and as you say, a teacher, which makes you kind of a full-time mother, right?
Full-time, overtime, extra time, yes.
You have two daughters, one of whom is autistic. Now, tell us a bit about that story.
Yes, Navia is 8 years old. She was diagnosed with autism when she was about 4, which was a funny story because at the time I was an autism teacher. And you know how sometimes we mothers can be. I was very stubborn when I saw the characteristics, and I said, "She'll grow out of it. She'll be fine." And she wasn't. So there were a few incidents that happened, and I just had to put on that advocate hat, and we started to get her the help she needed. And about 4 years later, 4 or 5 years later, she has flourished into the most beautiful, talkative child that I have ever been able to be blessed to witness and grow with. She still has her challenges, but...
How interesting that you would be, and you must have been a compassionate teacher. You deal with children with autism.
Yes.
I'm guessing you didn't think this was any kind of a stigma when you were working with these children who you loved, and yet you resisted the idea that it could be your daughter.
I did, because I think of just watching what my other students had to go through and just, you know, seeing how difficult it was for them to be accepted by their peers and even some of their own family members. That's not something that I wanted my own daughter to have to go through. But I had to kind of flip it around and say, well, you know, it's not her responsibility for the world to accept her. You know, she's going to be what she is, and the world is going to have to accept her or not. And so I just went from there, and she's learning to be her own advocate while I'm doing it for her.
But embedded in that would be your responsibility to help her through that and also endure with her whatever she may have to endure.
And we go through lots of things that has to do with diet, where she thinks every night is Taco Tuesday. That's all she'll eat. There are times where we'll go to a restaurant, and all of a sudden it's, "I don't want to go in there, Mom. I'm not going." And which is a blessing, honestly, because now she can voice that. Before, it was just straight meltdown.
We also talked about your role as a teacher, and not only do you teach a full load, then you have an after-school project that
you teach.
Tell us about that.
I teach at a school here in Durham, fifth grade. I've been teaching in North Carolina for the past 17 years. 6 of those 17 years, I have been the director of a program called Men of Honor. It's a group for at-risk youth after school. Mostly I serve a socioeconomic challenged group of African-American and Hispanic males, and my mission is to prevent them from falling through the cracks. So we do lots of things. We have guest speakers that come in and speak to them. We go on college tours. We go and see local businesses. They have chess club, debate, spoken word, and of course I have to feed them.
Yeah, well, I'm saying this all, this is a challenging project that happens at the end of your school day.
Yes, right after school, 2 days a week, I have about 47 boys who run straight to my classroom.
And then when you're done, you go home to your children.
And I go home to my middle schooler and my other child, and it's nonstop.
Well, I mean, we've got two other moms here, but so far you're a candidate for Mom of the Year.
Well, thank you.
We have to hear more. Would you read a little bit from your piece?
Sure, I will. Okay. 3:45 p.m., the dismissal bell rings, and the last child leaves my classroom that they've kept neat and orderly throughout the day, or not, but you know it's my fantasy. Bathroom break. Psych, just kidding. Teachers do not get breaks, bathroom or otherwise. 3:45 to 5:30, for the past 6 years, I've been spending time with my sons, 47 of them at the time. Almost five dozen energetic and smelly. That smell, y'all, there is no earthly description for pre-puberty boys. These fourth and fifth grade boys that have spent their day sitting in a desk and now just really want to go outside and play basketball and eat a snack. They don't mind extending their school day because at Men of Honor, they know they'll get food, help with homework, and be safe from the streets. Instead of just socializing and running around, however, we talk about drugs and respect for themselves, their teachers, their parents. I try to emphasize and enhance with them the skills and tools so they'll be able to grow up and out of the cycle of poverty and become positive members of the world so they can become men of honor. As we all know, boys will become men eventually, and like milk, there's an expiration date.
That was Nishanda Cook, a teacher in Durham Public Schools, talking about her Men of Honor After School program. It was a segment that listener Barbara Rohde called one of her favorites this past year. And we'll hear from more listeners when we return to the State of Things. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, looking back at 2016 through the ears of our listeners, listener favorites from the past year. We've got some great selections so far, from discussions about important political and social issues to conversations about pop culture and science. And our final two segments feature some of the work we do to bring the diverse and talented music scene around North Carolina to our listeners. Let's get right to it and hear from one of our listeners.
My name is Gary Patterson, and I live in Durham, North Carolina. I'm a former chapel choir member, and I currently sing with the Evensong Choir. My favorite show from the past year was the live Duke Chapel recording, right after the chapel reopened. It was really moving to hear the chapel choir sing again. The energy and the warmth and the excitement was palpable, and being able to hear them sing so wonderfully and expressively, as well as to hear the organ roar back to life after being silenced for a year, was incredibly moving and just really exciting. It's like coming home in a lot of ways.
That was listener Gary Patterson telling us why he liked our live recording from Duke Chapel back in May. That was right after the chapel reopened to the public following a year-long restoration project. And we're going to hear now from a portion of that broadcast that features 62 members of the Duke Chapel Choir. I began by asking choir director Rodney Weinkoop to tell us more about the history of the choir.
The choir existed as early as the university was being built. There were services here. The choir sang even before there was a roof on top. Often a community gathered together, 150 singers, one of the first services here, townspeople and students and the like. And one of the first things they ever sang here was, "The heavens are telling the glory of God." And it has existed as a community group, both students and non-students, ever since.
Well, that's an interesting point right there, that it is students and non-students and community members, as you say, all blended to make this choir, right?
And one of the great things about that is that it's like an extended family. We have generations of people in the choir, and it doesn't matter to us, you know, what religion you are, if you even have a religion. It doesn't matter what age you are or what profession. It doesn't even matter whether you're part of Duke or not. We just bring people together who love to make music in worship, and it works beautifully. And students will tell us sometimes that they talk to some of the older people in the choir, and they even call them grandpa or grandma, and the older folks make them feel so comforted and welcome. They ask about their homework, and it's like a living, breathing community.
That's great. Did you do your homework? Because if not, you're not going to sing. No. Well, I wonder if we can hear a sample right now.
This is actually going to be a spiritual called Give Me Jesus, arranged by Larry Fleming.
Those were some of the members of the Duke Choir performing Give Me Jesus during the reopening of Duke Chapel in May, in fact, May 11th of 2016, and it was listener Gary Patterson's favorite broadcast from the past year. Our final listener selection is also music. Let's hear from Peter Burke.
I'm Peter Burke. I live in Carrboro, and I'm a local jazz fan to the point where I started my own website called Locavore Jazz, which you can just Google and find. And I lead a class called Guide to Local Jazz through Duke University. And that's all because I've gotten to know the local jazz scene. That there's an awful lot going on between just that you look at the universities. UNC and NCCU have jazz programs that are producing musicians that are playing locally. You've got musicians that have been playing here for a long time. And it's a challenge to keep up with everything that's going on while I'm trying to do that and go out and listen to local jazz. And I look to State of Things to tell me about new things in jazz because they catch up on things that I'm not always aware of. For example, my favorite program this year was Chris Stamey, who's a rock musician who's listened to a lot of jazz in the past and now has come back into it by creating new standards that that will possibly turn into new jazz standards, new pop standards, which jazz needs these days. There's lots and lots in the past, but there's an awful lot going on here. And again, State of Things has done a good job in keeping me up with jazz in this area, in addition to whatever else I'm doing.
That was listener Peter Burke telling us why he liked our jazz coverage in general, and the show in particular, a segment we did featuring musician and producer Chris Stamey. And we're going to listen to a little bit of this show. I began by asking Chris Stamey to tell me more about the inspiration for Occasional Shivers, which features 1960s-era songs that his dad used to play.
Well, growing up, you know, I would try to imitate my dad. He would leave off to his medical practice, and I would sit there and kind of plunk out my own versions of those songs in a tinker toy way. But coming back to the piano, I think I was able to find that child in a way. I think that I came to realize that maybe creativity is always that kid at the beach and you find a little stone you like and then there's another one and you see how they fit together. And it's only after the fact you start to talk about the vernacular of the American songbook or something. Well,
and what are some of the songs you remember most clearly, most fondly?
A lot of them are World War II things. I'll Be Home for Christmas. I'll See You in My Dreams. He would also play Chopin, Rachmaninoff, and, you know, of course, Gershwin, Cole Porter, Jerome Kern.
So tell us about this project, then. You're not playing those songs. You've composed your own songs kind of in the spirit of some of those.
Yeah, and I don't think that Ira and George Gershwin really need anyone reimagining them. They did a pretty good job of imagination. But what I did find very intriguing is opening up into 4- and 5-note chords, into a richer harmonic palette. And on the piano, you know, you can spread things out more on guitar. So that spoke to me. And also, I think lyrically, you can more polysyllabic words. Is that onomatopoeia? Polysyllabic? No, it defines itself, though. A richer, more erudite lyrical vocabulary. If you're playing guitar really loud, you kind of just want to say, "I want you."
Or and sometimes I want you to stop, depending on how well you're playing. But I get your point, yes.
As I got the piano, I was also working on a record with Sherston and with a great group of North Carolina jazz players, including John Brown, Wes Lachaud, Jim Crew, Scott, Bill Frizzell, Niels Klein. And we started needing a little more material, so I said, "Well, Sherston, here's one." Came over on Christmas morning, I think I'd written one for you. We're going to do that one, right?
Well, why don't we do, give us a sample of what we're going to hear, and maybe going to do a little medley first. Is that
we are. We're going to do a few of the more mellow ones. The guys had other things to do, so the gals are joining us today.
Right.
Here are the two of the earliest songs I wrote for Sherston's record.
Okay. I didn't mean to fall in love with you. It was the last thing that I'd want to do. Across a crowded room, I saw you there, waving your hand in the air. I didn't know that it would come to this, to go from strangers to a goodnight kiss. The curtains and the breeze, strange melodies, champagne at 40 degrees. Now I find I spend all my time counting the seconds till I see you again. Church bells chime and the subways grind, but in my mind I'm there with you. In my mind I'm there with you. What is this music that I hear whenever you the thrill of it is exquisite and strange. The glare and clatter of the crowd, which once it seemed so loud, has vanished and your melody remains. I thought that Lepro Coffee was all that I had left to while away the hours of the day. But now old Serge Rachmaninoff seems sentimental fluff, and Gershwin is 5,000 miles away. What is this music that I hear? What is this music that I hear? Each time I find you standing there, what is this music that I hear? What is this music that I hear?
That's a medley that featured pianist Julian Lambert, guitarist Scott Sawyer, and vocalist Kirsten Lambert and Millie McGuire. Part of a show we did in September that featured producer and musician Chris Stamey and his new narrative song cycle called Occasional Shivers. WUNC's been working with Chris Stamey to turn Occasional Shivers into a romantic radio drama, and it will air this Friday right here in this spot instead of our program, so you'll get to hear the whole production this Friday. Well, I want to just point out that Peter Burke is not the only one who appreciates our coverage of live music. I do, too, and I know you do. And I want to just tell you that to do live music the way we do on this show week after week, and some specials that we bring you monthly from Greensboro and sometimes from places like the Duke Chapel, requires an awful lot of technical skill. And I have deep appreciation for Robin Copley in particular. Al Wadarski often helps out. These folks and our technical production crew make it possible to do the impossible, which is to bring you live music directly to your ears. So I'm grateful for them in this holiday season. And others who bring you The State of Things: Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser, our producers. And our news director, Brent Wolf, is WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.